Chicago used to say that I was the best ad-libber on the radio that they ever heard, except the broadcasters. They wouldn't put me up with them, but I beat everybody else, you know. The boys that broadcast the games in Chicago.
I've ad-libbed newscasts. I've gone on, all I had was something penciled down, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes the best ones. One morning, all I had time to do was write it down because so much happened overnight. Police beat and everything. Mm-hmm. Boss came in and said, "That's the best one you've ever done." I didn't even have it written.
Yes.
Let me ask you, start from the beginning here.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about your genealogy, about your mom and your dad and where you came from.
Well, my father was born in Camden County, Missouri. My grandfather was Dan Chandler, and he had married Mary Terrell of Trimble County. And they married down in the River Valley across the river from Madison, Indiana, in what they call the Pleasant Valley neighborhood. Answer that thing, and let's see what it is, and then we'll go from there.
Hello.
Want me to get it for you?
Are you ready?
Yeah, you were telling me about your where you came from.
Yeah, my grandfather was Dan Chandler, and he was born in Trimble County, Kentucky, and he was a Southern soldier during the war between the states and was a second sergeant in Morgan's Cavalry. I got the papers on him. He was shot in the heel at Shiloh. I always teased him about that one during my boyhood. I said, "Granddaddy, near as I can figure out," I said, you were running. And he said, near as he could figure out, everybody else was running. He said they were all running. But he got shot in the heel, and he had that limp all the rest of his life. He had a slight limp in his leg. And so Granddaddy married Mary Terrell, and she lived in Trimble County. And after the war between the states, they covered wagoned out across the Ohio and the Mississippi River, down way down in western Kentucky, and went out in the Ozark Hill Country and homesteaded out there. And in 1870, my father was born in Camden County, Missouri. After 10 years out there, 10 or 12 years, they came back to Kentucky and settled in Henderson County. And some of the Terrell family settled in Union County. I knew them, Uncle Rich Terrell and others, friends of mine and kinsmen, came back across the river from Missouri and settled in Union County, Kentucky, around Grove Center. That's below Morganfield. So Daddy was a little fellow when they came back, and after he came back to Kentucky, his three younger two brothers and a sister were born in western Kentucky. That's Uncle Wade and Uncle Steve and Aunt Ollie. Not Aunt Ollie, Aunt Bess. And Aunt Bess is still living. And she's 90-some-odd. She's the only one that's left. They all lived a long time. Aunt Bess lives now outside of Atlanta, and she's about 96 years old. So Dad grew up on a farm in western Kentucky then after my grandfather came back to western Kentucky. And my mother was born in Garrard County, and she was a Sanders, S-A-N-D-E-R-S. And that's quite a name over there. There's still a lot of Sanders people left over there in Garrard County. And Daddy and Mother got married, and they settled in a little town, right in the outskirts of a little town called Carden, Kentucky, in western Kentucky. And this little farm is about a mile north of Carden on a side road, right off the main number 60 road. And I was born there on the 14th day of July, 1898.
You're a cancer of the crab.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Cancer.
I'm one too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I'm a July 8th.
That's right. July 14th. Now, July 14th was the day the Spanish surrendered to the Americans at Santiago. That's historically important. It's also Bastille Day, of course, in France, that day. And the doctor that delivered me was in San Juan, Puerto Rico, when Teddy Roosevelt made his charge up the hill. And Dr. Ben Compton. And that's where I got that Ben in my name, Benjamin. My daddy named me for Albert Wetzel, who was a close neighbor of ours, a German farmer who lived next farm to us. So they were great friends of ours, Albert and Ms. Wetzel. And Benjamin was the name of Dr. Ben Cupton, so they named me Albert Benjamin Chandler. And I was the first son of Joseph Cephas. My father's name was Joseph Cephas, named for the great historian, you know, old-time historian, and Callie Sanders Chandler. And I first saw the light of day on this little farm, July 14, 1898.
Where did you go to school?
I went to the common schools in Henderson County, mostly at Cardin, in that neighborhood there. There were some country schools. Rock Springs I went for a while, and but mostly at Cardin. And I graduated from the common schools there and from the high school in 1917 at Cardin, Kentucky.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
One brother. From this first marriage of my father and first marriage of my mother, Robert, and he got killed when he was 14. He fell out of a cherry tree and broke his neck. If he had fallen out of that cherry tree 25 or 30 years later, he probably would have lived, but they didn't have anybody to look out for him then. So he had a hard time, lived about a week after his fall, but they didn't know what to do with him. The doctors were not wise. So years later, 20-odd years later, Dad married again and had two children with that second wife. And my mother married a couple of times and died in Florida. Her name at the time of her death was Mrs. Chamberlain. And she's buried in the cemetery in Jacksonville. I was there when she was buried. My dad lived to be 90, and he's buried at Cardin. That's where he lived most of his adult life.
Did you attend the University of Kentucky?
Oh, yes. I went first, though, in 1917 to Transylvania, the oldest college west of the Allegheny Mountains, and I graduated there in 21 with a Bachelor of Arts degree. And I played on all the teams while I was there and was captain of the teams in Transylvania and made a pretty good athletic record. I was not a great athlete, but a fair one. A journeyman was a ball player and a quarterback on the football team and guard on the basketball team and pitcher on the baseball team and made a pretty good record. I've got a baseball signed to me by Frank Callaway, who was the shortstop for the University of Tennessee and later was with Mr. Connie Mack in the Philadelphia Athletics. In 1920, I pitched against Tennessee and beat them 10-4. I guess that was my most notable accomplishment. Tennessee, of course, always had good teams.
Did you, was there such a thing as a major at the university when you went? Did you major in a subject?
No. I had already graduated Bachelor of Arts, and I graduated in the law school out there.
Oh, that's right.
And then took law at Harvard, too, at Harvard Law School. I graduated from the University Law School in 1924.
So your Bachelor of Arts degree at Transylvania was general curriculum?
Yeah, just general, history major.
Well, what about your sports career now before you got to college? You must have started out pretty young playing baseball.
I played on the sandlot. I made the all-conference team in Western Kentucky in high school. And I hit 456 for 4 years at college. I was a pretty fair hitter and had a pretty good college record. And played in three leagues. I played in the North Dakota State League up there in 1920. They called it the Red River Valley League. I played in the Bluegrass League at Lexington. I played with the Lexington Rios, and I played with this Central Kentucky League over here, Lawrenceburg and Bowling Green and Bardstown, those people. Then I managed a team in the mountains 1 year for the Swiss Oil Corporation. I was the manager of that team, and that team didn't lose a game. We had a pretty good team.
When was it you played down at Taylorsville?
In 1920, when I came back from the North Dakota State League. That year, at the end of the season, I had gone to Saskatoon in the West Canadian League and gotten a tryout. And I had a good chance to go back out there, but I didn't want to go back out there because I had other plans here. But I came back from North Dakota, and the most amazing thing was I went over there to sing in the choir for Kenneth Bowen, who was a preacher at the Christian Church. I sang and was a religious boy. And so they had me over there to sing at that meeting, and they gave me $35 a week and fed me, which was, oh my, what a lot of money that was, you know. $70 I got for 2 weeks over there. It looked like a bale of hay, you know. And so I sang for that meeting, sang a religious song every night, you know, while my friend preached, you know. And he and I were PAC-A friends at college, so he got me to go over there. So they had Edwin Wilkinson, and you remember him, and Roy Stratton, and young Cox, whose father ran the grocery store. He was a catcher. They knew I was a ball player, so they got me to play baseball with them. And the first game we played was against Fairfield, and the Fairfield boys didn't want me to pitch because I was a league pitcher. They didn't want to play. And for a long time, I thought maybe they were going to put me out because they didn't want me to play. And I never will forget, Fairfield had one very good player, at least they thought he was a good player, a boy named Walters. And I think I struck the first two men out, and then Walters hit the ball back to me, and I threw him out. He hit it, but by gosh, they were so surprised that he hit it. And they all commented around, he hit it. But we beat them 7-0, which was pretty conclusive, and Edwin Wilkinson over there was the first baseman. He was my very good friend. Roy Stratton ran the drugstore for the Fromans and lived with them. And the Froman girl was his sweetheart, and she died. And they just took Roy in. That was a tragic thing, but Roy was a fine boy. And his brother played with the Louisville Colonels. His brother played with them. And we had some good baseball people. They were very interested. And then I was over there singing at the church and visiting around. And one day we went out to, what's this town you said, the other town out there?
Elm Creek.
Went out there and played a game. And baseball diamonds up on the hill, and the churchyard was down below there across the road. And we had the bases loaded, and they stopped the game to marry this couple at the home plate. And I followed and hit a home run over the road down there, over into the churchyard with the bases loaded. I'll never forget that. But Elk Creek, I had a great time playing there. So, except the fact that all the other teams protested me because they said I was a league player. They didn't want. Finally, they appealed to their courage. You know, or they made them half mad, and they said, "Well, we're not afraid." You know, of course, my side always said they were cowards and scared. You know, and so finally, they made them mad, and they agreed to play. They didn't do very well. We won this game 20-some-odd to, I think, 2. They didn't let me pitch all the time because I threw the ball pretty good, and I was experienced beyond them. And at that time, I was about 20 years old, 20, 21, you know. And so, throw the ball pretty good. But I had lots of fun over in Taylorsville. I'll never forget that. That was a great country.
What was your best pitch?
I always said it was a bat dodger, you know. That's what everybody tried. Satchel Paige told me he threw two good pitches. He said one of them was a hesitation pitch, and the other was a bat dodger. And Satchel said if I had been commissioner, he would have won 30 games for 30 years. Of course, old Judge Landis, my predecessor in the baseball commissioners, always wouldn't let the black boys play. And I broke that color line. I made that decision in the cabin here when Mr. Rickey came down to ask me to let Jackie Robinson play. The owners had voted 15-1 not to let him play. But, of course, they weren't running it. They ran it while the old judge was there. People don't seem to realize that, you know, because they always imagined the old judge was the last word, but that was not so. Lots of times you hear stories about a myth, you know, and you're apt to believe it. But he was conscious of the fact that the owners didn't want him to let him play. So for 24 years, he wouldn't let black boys play. So in the face of a 15-1 vote, I brought him in.
What was your thinking about?
Well, I say, I believe in the Lord God Almighty, and I think He'll punish you if you offend even one of the least of these. And if I just had arbitrarily said to this fellow because he's black that he couldn't play something that he could play, he was proficient, he was capable. And if I had deprived him of his opportunity to do what he manifestly could do and what he did do in this sport, I think I would have been wrong. I don't believe you can do that just because a fellow's a black fella. I didn't figure it out that way.
Well, you'd been playing baseball a long time, and you'd obviously seen good black athletes.
Oh, sure, lots of them. Lots of them.
And
lots of them lived.
Lots of them lived
and died and never got to play either. And I thought it was a great pity, and I wasn't going to be responsible for that. I would have been ashamed of myself if the only reason I could have signed to it was that he was a black boy. And that's the only I couldn't. Otherwise, he was eligible, he was capable, and proved it. You see, but he wouldn't have proved it if I had done just what my predecessor said. And that's what the American people have not yet caught on to. And I'll not be able to convince them. A lot of them think Landis was all-powerful and equal to God Almighty in doing this thing. But after all, we are all humans, and we all make errors. And I thought that was an egregious error that he made in failure to let him play. He has to answer for it, or somebody has to answer for it. I wasn't gonna arbitrarily say that because this fellow's a black fella, he can't play. And Bob, I wasn't willing to do that. And my conscience would have not permitted me to. Now, when they got me, they were anxious about that. They understood about that then. And they thought I was a Southerner, and I was. They thought I was a Confederate, and I was. But still, I wasn't going to do that. And my predecessor was a Yankee and a Union man and Republican and all those things. And he did it, but not me.
Abe Lincoln was a Southerner.
Sure. We were better to him in the long run. Pee Wee Reese was better to Jackie Robinson almost than anybody else. Pee Wee Reese was very helpful to him. And, of course, I'm one of Pee Wee Reese's best friends, and I'm one of his admirers, and he's a fine boy. And after I made the decision, Pee-wee helped him more than anybody there that I know on the field. Of course, we fought the battle with him. I told these fellows, if you make trouble for him, I'll make trouble for you. They said, how are we going to treat him, commissioners? I said, just as another ball player, no better, no worse. He don't look at him like he's black, white, red, or yellow. He's another ball player. And he's entitled to whatever treatment that you give to any other ball player. So just treat him like you do the others. He was a little difficult to get along with. He had a chip on his shoulder, and it wasn't easy to make the switch. It was much easier with some of the others. Some of the others acclimated themselves quicker and better and got along better than Robinson. Robinson was so he had a chip on his shoulder. He won't take up, maybe too quick sometimes. But we looked out for him. We saw to it that he told me one day, he said, DeRocher called me a son of a bitch. And I said, well, what'd you do? He said, I called him a son of a bitch. Well, I said, that makes you even. You may both be sons of bitches, but I said, that makes you even, so we just let you go from there. As long as they didn't do something to him that he couldn't do to them, you understand, we'll let it go, but anytime they undertook to deprive him of what was his manifest rights and responsibilities and duties, and or keep him from exercising his manifest rights, then we didn't permit it.
Did you receive any loud outcrying any time at the beginning of his career from anybody wanting you to suspend him, fine him, or do anything to him because they just didn't like him?
Oh, well, no, a lot of them didn't like him, but they knew better than that. They wasn't in a way. When I made the decision, it was irrevocable. One thing about it, the commissioner had the authority to. Ricky came here to see me at the cabin on the backside of my place here and said, Commissioner, in the face of that vote, I can't bring him in unless I have your support. And I said, bring him in. Of course, when contract time came for 7 years later, on a 7-year contract later, that had a lot to do with my not being having it renewed. But I had a job when I got that one, so I wasn't looking for any job, and I wasn't looking to keep any at that expense, you understand. But some of the Southern boys, like Dixie Walker and them, said they weren't going to play with him. They made plenty of statements about Dixie, I said he's going to paint his house. He said he wasn't going back to camp. And some of them threatened to leave, and some of them threatened to jump. They didn't do it. They threatened, but they didn't do it.
That was a good experience when they saw what a ball player he was.
He was a good ball player. He was. He had great talent. He had great speed, and he had good reflexes. He was well conditioned. He was really a fine athlete, fine football player, and a fine baseball player. His own disposition was against him. He made a lot of enemies.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
I didn't want to interrupt you.
No.
I just wanted to ask you one thing.
Yeah.
You were a quarterback when you played football.
Yes.
What was your biggest play that you can recall?
Well, it's got to be my play against Center College in 1920. Center College had one of the greatest teams that was ever in this country prior to that time. You've heard of that McMillan team. They beat us 56-0 this day, and I was playing quarterback for Transylvania. Of course, that's a right solid beating, you understand. I kicked off 7 times and for my team. Of course, every time they made a touchdown, well, I had to kick off again, you know, so it kicked off a lot of times. So I made the play on the kickoff 5 times out of the 7 kickoffs. I backed up the line all day. I intercepted a pass in about the 3rd quarter and ran it back to the 10-yard line again. It came within 10 yards of being a hero. Nobody could score on them, nearly, and I came within 10 yards of being a hero. They knocked me out of bounds on the 10-yard line. But the papers that you can go back and read in that time characterized my play as being a star of the game, which is right nice against that kind of opposition. Well, the great tribute to me was that when the game was over, Red Roberts, who weighed 240 pounds and was one of the greatest players in the history of American football, carried me off the field on his shoulder. Not to my dressing room, but to his. And they took my clothes off for me. I'd taken a pretty bad beating, and I'd played all the game. I played the whole time. We didn't have but 17 players on our team. They had 30-some-odd, and they kept rushing in. That's 3 teams. We didn't have but about a team and a half. And they as a tribute to me, they took me off the field and took my clothes off for me. And Uncle Charlie Moran gave me a job after that scouting for him. And in 1921, I scouted the Harvard team for him. That's the year we won and sat on the bench. And Center beat Harvard 6-0. And I carried the football that McMillan carried across the goal line for the 6 points. I carried it back from the Harvard Stadium up to Cambridge and back on the subway to the Lenox Hotel and gave it back to Bo after the game. I had the game football. So I was right well. And then for the next 10 years, I coached and scouted for Center College. But Uncle Charlie gave me the job, and it was out of respect for my, as he said, a tribute to my coaching. I coached here for 7 years and won 35 games and lost 15 and tied 5. So that's pretty good records. The high school team here.
He played some basketball, didn't he?
Oh, yes. I played basketball 4 years for Transylvania and was captain of the team. I was All-Kentucky guard in 1920.
What kind of shot did you have?
They wouldn't let me shoot the first 2 years I was there. They had standing guards in those days. The floors were small, and really wasn't room enough for 10 big fellows. He kept throwing everybody in the stands. The stands were up close right along the side, and a capacity crowd, of course, was 300 or 400 or 500. Geez, it wasn't a lot of people go now, but we didn't have, I think, the biggest crowd maybe I ever played before was 500 or 600. And I played at Louisville. I played against the University of Louisville often. But the first 2 years I was there, they didn't permit me past the middle of the floor. I was the roughest one, and I was the standing guard. It was my business to knock them off, and if they got a shot at the board, to get the rebound and get it out of there. And they usually jump on top of my back and on my head, and they bump me pretty good, but I got the ball most of the time. Then the 3rd year, I was the running guard, and I scored 14 points. It's still in the record books. I scored 14 points one night at Louisville against the University of Louisville. I think that was my high for scoring points. They didn't score very many points in the game.
I was going to say that was a high in those days.
Oh, gee, if a fellow scored 14 points, he was. And we beat Louisville that night, 24-14, and I made 14 points. I made as many as their whole team made. And I thought that pretty good. But anyway, the last 2 years, I was permitted to sort of take part in the play. But the first 2 years, I never got past the middle of the floor.
When did you start practicing law right after college? Or?
1924, I took the bar examinations. That's the year I got my law degree at the university. I made 87 and 11/16 general average. That's nearly 88, and that's a high average. We took 16 subjects in 2 days, 8 one day and 8 the next. It was an endurance contest and was right rugged. But I got 87 and 11/16. Never going to forget that. I had just 5/16 being an average of 88 for 16 subjects, which was pretty good. And there have been a few better than that, but not a whole lot. That's in the top few. So I started practicing law that summer here, 1924.
Well, were you coaching and practicing law?
Yeah. I used to tell them facetiously, although it was true, that I was a lawyer by profession and I made my living coaching football. I got $80 a month for teaching two classes in the afternoon and coaching the football team.
What was your first taste of politics?
Well, from 1924 to 1929, I practiced law here in this little country town. And we were raising a family. Mimi was born in 25. And Mom and I had gotten married in 24. And I had been appointed Master Commissioner of the Circuit Court by Judge Williams in 1928. That was the first time I'd had any public office at all, and that's appointed by the judge. And Master Commissioner of the Court is the Chancellor of the Circuit Court and sort of the keeper of the judge's conscience. And he hears equity cases for the judge when he's away and makes reports on them and sells property under the orders of the court. And I was just the local fellow for the circuit judge. Now, the circuit was Franklin and Scott and Woodford counties. Of course, Franklin later grew to be a great big one and is now has a judge of its own, you know. But Scott County over Georgetown and Woodford County and Franklin County was the judicial district. So I was the master commissioner for this county. In 1929, we were the 14th senatorial district, and that district was composed of Jessamine, Woodford, and Scott County. And under they used a sort of an agreement by term, and it came our time under the rules and under the regulations of the three counties, understanding of the three counties, for Woodford County to have the Senate, the senator. This is 1929 for the 1930 session of the General Assembly. So I was still a football coach and still teaching. They asked me to run for the Senate. So I ran, and I got elected real good. I was nominated by a tremendous majority. My majority in Scott County was 2,556. I'll never forget that. That was unprecedented. The majority in this county was 1,100 and some odd, as it was in Jessamine. But these are smaller counties. So I won that race by about 5,000 majority, nearly, in three counties. And I think records probably show that I didn't lose but two precincts in the whole district. So that was a real good race. So in January of 1930, I went to the state senate from the 14th senatorial district. I was only there 2 years. I was only there for the 30th session, because in 1931, that's the last time they've had a nominating convention in Kentucky to nominate people for public office. 1931 was the last time. And I was nominated for lieutenant governor. I'd only been half a term. But I was nominated for lieutenant governor with Ruby LaFoon. Ruby LaFoon was nominated for governor in 31. And in the fall election of 31, we were elected. So then I spent 4 years as lieutenant governor. I always said I was born too soon because at that time the lieutenant governor had an office, but no salary. I got $15 a day when the Senate was in session for presiding over it. Now the lieutenant governor gets $18,000. He's got an office. He's got a secretary. Got numerous secretaries. Got a house. Got maintenance. Got protection. Got a nice house. The old governor's mansion. But I fixed that when I was there, when I was the governor.
Well, did you raise that much, Kane, when you were a senator to make yourself known, or were you just a popular fellow?
Well, I didn't raise Cain. I never did raise Cain. And the record won't show that. I wasn't any hell raiser, and I never was a drunk. I was always sober. But I made a pretty good record in the Senate, and I did make friends, and the people. I was the youngest member. I was just 30 years old.